for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The House and Senate reveal competing budget plans. A congressional stalemate stalls the confirmation of Loretta Lynch. And the Federal Reserve signals it may raise interest rates later this year. Joining me for the Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Ed O'Keefe of the Washington Post, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, and Jeff Mason of Reuters. And don't forget, you can watch this hour of the Friday News Roundup. We're streaming at drshow.org. Watch live. You can also call us, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Happy spring, everybody.
Good to be with you.
You too, Diane. Good morning.
Good morning.
And with your pink tie.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely great.
Have to think optimistically.
Absolutely. Even though it's snowing outside here in Washington and in the Washington area. So, Ed O'Keefe, we've got competing budget plans, one from the House and Senate, which are competing between themselves, and then you've got the White House plan. So how is this going to move forward?
Well, it all depends on the Republicans at this point. You made the point that it's really almost three plans, because
you've
got a House version, you've got a Senate version, and then you got the president sitting on the sidelines going, I don't like either of these ideas. There's a lot of expectation on Republicans that they will get a budget passed this year. But this week suggests it's going to be awfully hard, if perhaps not at all possible, to get it done. The reason is essentially a fight between military hawks in the Republican ranks and deficit hawks, those that are worried about how much money is actually getting spent. Basically, either the GOP plans cuts about $5 trillion over the next decade, mostly by cutting domestic programs. And you've got competing ideas on how exactly defense spending should go. Mm-hmm. Remember the 2011 budget deal that set the caps that we've been living under ever since? 2016's budget's supposed to be about $523 billion. The president asked for $38 billion above that cap. Some Republicans are asking for as much as $94 billion above that cap. How that would happen is basically the crux of the disagreement, and the one that could make it very difficult next week for the House and Senate to pass their budget plans.
So, Amy, you've got on the one hand the military hawks. You've got on the other hand the White House saying you cannot keep cutting these expenditures for the middle class.
Right. I mean, this is what the president ran on in 2012. And we've heard about the Ryan budget now in just about every congressional campaign, presidential campaign, since Paul Ryan unveiled it in 2010. And this has been sort of a staple of Democratic attacks, which is, you know, Republicans say they want to balance the budget, they want to cut the deficit, but they're looking to the wrong places. Now, the other difference between the Senate plan and the House plan, and this is another intra-party divide here among Republicans, is what to do about entitlement spending, right? That's the biggest driver of the deficit.
Huge.
We all know that.
Yeah.
Now, what Democrats say is not only do Republicans cut discretionary spending, that is supposed to be the social safety net, but also the entitlement social safety net, turning the Medicare program into what they call a voucher-like program. The Senate budget plan doesn't do that. And what you hear a lot of Republicans saying is, we have to talk about entitlements. A lot of Republicans, especially those, let's say, I don't know, running for president in 2016,
for example,
if just throwing out an example, don't want to talk about reforming either Social Security or Medicare right before the election.
I think it's important to note in any discussion about the budget, particularly with the parties that we're talking about, the White House and Congress, about the theater involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that a budget actually hasn't been passed in ages, and the fact that it's an opportunity for both sides to talk about what they care about, but in the end, nothing may get passed at all.
Nothing? simply a continuing resolution.
Exactly, to keep the government running, and they fall back on that. But it's not, I mean, of course, it's very big. It's particularly important for candidates, as Amy said, and others who are running for re-election, which is everyone in this town, essentially, except for the president, to showcase their values. And the president's budget was also an opportunity for him to sort of showcase what he wants to do with the rest of his term. But at the end of the day, a lot of this comes down to theater.
Well, and I remember sitting down right before the 2014 election, talking to a number of congressional Republicans saying, what would it matter if you all were in the majority? What would change? And they said the most important thing we can do to show that we can govern is to pass a budget. That's what we're going to do. We will show everybody who thinks we can't run this town that we can do it. And now look what's happening.
And the problem is that each chamber is supposed to spend next week right before the Easter break doing this. But again, that deficit hawk versus military hawk fight might rob Republicans of getting the votes needed, because Democrats have said, we are not voting for these things no matter what. We don't like them. It's all on the backs of Republicans. Mm-hmm. So this year, if there's no budget, or if the budget process stalls all the way to the end of the fiscal year, it's totally on the backs of Republicans. And that becomes a real problem for them.
And
it's
they
already,
know it.
And they know it. And presidential candidates know it. I would note that Scott Walker and Jeb Bush, who've been out there for the last few weeks, repeatedly say the number one thing Washington can do is return to regular order and pass a budget. Mm-hmm. That's a way of distinguishing themselves from the three or four lawmakers who are running for president, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, and Ted Cruz, and saying, I'm not of that town. I want to come in there and fix things up.
And you've been spending time with Jeb Bush. Have you heard precisely those words?
He says repeatedly in every appearance he makes, it becomes the answer to almost every big question he has, that Washington needs to return to regular order. Just pass a budget. Just pass a budget, darn it, he says over and over again. Because he says if you can do that, you're basically setting the legislative table and the parameters of what Congress and the White House can do together on immigration, on entitlement reform, on energy, on every other issue. And he said this week, I'm thrilled to see that it's starting. I'm psyched that it's going to get passed this year. He may be disappointed. And if that's the case, well, he can say, oh, well, you know, I said they should. They had an opportunity to do it. They squandered it. How about you elect me instead? I'll go to Washington and make sure they do it.
How can any Republican or Democratic candidate change the tenor of Washington?
That is the question to be answered over the next 19 months as we near that next election. But I think that's one of the major things that people want to know as they meet these candidates, for sure.
So you, Jeff, are probably not alone in thinking there may be nothing except a continuing resolution.
I think that's probably true, and I think it's also interesting to see how the White House is reacting this week. Just as Republicans were fighting over their own versions, as we've been talking about, the president went to Cleveland and said, I take some credit for the economy. And
should
he also
get it?
Right, well, that's a good question. I think reasonable people will disagree on that, but his policies have certainly helped the economy get to where it is today, for
Amy,
sure.
Amy, do you agree?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. The Wall Street Journal NBC poll that came out this week actually asked that question. It said, if the economy, what describes your views of the economy during Obama's presidency? 47% say the economy's improved, and I give Obama some credit for it, which is actually higher than people gave to Bill Clinton back in the mid to late 90s. 21% say, yeah, I think the economy's gotten better. I don't give Obama credit. And then 31% say it hasn't improved. Now, what's interesting, that 31% is actually a lot lower than it was a year ago. It was 41% saying, I don't think the economy's improved at all. So people are seeing the economy improving. They're giving Obama credit. Here's the difference. They're not feeling any more optimistic that things are going to be better next year. In other words, they say, yeah, it's gotten better since 2009, but I don't know that things are going to get better next year. Only half of Americans say, I'm optimistic that things are going to get better.
You know, here's the thing. The unemployment rate has been cut in half, expected to keep falling, at least in the Fed's mind. Raises in salaries perhaps have not gone up as quickly as the Fed would like to see, which is why they're postponing the rise in the interest rates. But how does Obama not get credit?
I think it's because Republicans have really trained their supporters and, frankly, probably all of us to dive deeper into those unemployment statistics. Mm-hmm. They say, look, the rate may be 5.3% or whatever it is right now, but look at the labor participation rate. Look at wage growth. Look at, you know, part-time work versus full-time work. Do people feel they're underemployed? And when you dive into those numbers, that's where you see the trouble.
But even that's changing.
It is improving. And the White House pointed out as he went to Ohio this week that they've created, 877,000 more manufacturing jobs since February of 2010, which they say is the fastest growth rate since the 80s. So, you know, they too can dive into the numbers and find success. But overall, Republicans, I think, have really mastered the debate by saying, look at participation rate, look at wage growth, and look at whether people feel they're underemployed.
I also think just politically it's very interesting that the White House is so sensitive to the fact that they're not getting credit for it. To hear the president come out and say, I'm going to take a little credit for that, is actually sort of unusual.
Yeah.
And they're annoyed. They are already
what
sensitive.
What should he have said?
Well, I can't say what he should have said, but I think it's interesting that he came out and needed some of that praise.
Well,
I mean, he's upset or getting criticism from his own party for not doing more on, you know, other issues, immigration in earlier in this term. What he did was save the economy.
Jeff Mason is White House correspondent at Reuters. Short break here, and don't forget, you can see all of our guests live video streaming at drshow.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CA Technologies, who believes that in the application economy, every business is in the software business. CA makes software to empower enterprises and help them thrive. More information is at ca.com. From PwC, the right people to get the extraordinary done. Learn more at pwc.com/extraordinary. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back. Three reporters are here with me, Jeff Mason of Reuters, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, and Ed O'Keefe of the Washington Post. Amy, let's talk about Loretta Lynch and her long wait for confirmation.
Yes.
Has it inched forward at all?
Sure doesn't feel like it this week. There was talk that this was going to be the week that she was going to get the vote. And the fact is, it was going to be a very, very close vote. A lot of Republicans who initially had said they would support her had started to peel off. Again, I think Jeff mentioned this before, the theater in Washington now. The dynamics with Loretta Lynch are as much about theater as anything else, which is Republicans right now frustrated about what they see as a White House imperialism on the issue of immigration, the fact that their own party kind of can't figure out a way to push an immigration bill through. And this was their way to show and vent their frustration about this, was to hold up Loretta Lynch, who they say would be complicit in supporting the White House's executive orders on deportation. So that was an excuse to hold her up for a while, or at least to vote against her. Now it gets caught up in a debate about abortion, which, again, is one more theater here for both sides.
And now racism introduces its ugly head.
Yeah, I mean, people are raising the question as to whether that's playing a role. She would be a historic nominee. She's an African-American woman succeeding an African-American man. She was nominated in November. It's been months, and it's not moving. And so, particularly at a time when the issue of racism is in the headlines for many other reasons in this country, that question is being asked with respect to her nomination as
now,
well.
The Democrats claim that it was actually, they did not discover that the Hyde Amendment had been included in the language because it was all in numbers. And finally, somebody saw it because of Planned Parenthood or some other outside pro-choice group pointing it out.
That's right. This is regarding the bill that's actually tying up the Senate right now. It's what they call an anti-human trafficking bill. It's essentially a way to go after people who profit from prostitution. It's been a big bipartisan concern for several years. It almost got through last year. And this is one of the few bipartisan accomplishments that Republicans have identified that they can get through this year. And they almost got it until, as you said, they noticed in there that a new compensation fund for the victims of human trafficking would bar people from spending money from that fund on abortions. Democrats claim they didn't see it until the last minute. Some of them did know about it and had seen it because they were involved in the negotiations. They used that as the excuse to muck things up. And then here we are waiting. And so McConnell did all that he can do. The only Trump card he has right now is Loretta Lynch. And the longer he holds that up, the more he can make Democrats squirm.
I'm going to push you on this, Ed. Which Democrats knew about it?
Aides to Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat of Minnesota, who has been negotiating this with Republicans, conceded this week through her that they had been aware of it. They probably just didn't raise the alarms to all the other Democrats as much. And then you're right, other groups noticed it and raised concerns with Democratic leaders as well.
Why would she not have raised the alarm herself?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know why, but perhaps it's that the bill itself was such a, making this bill happen in the first place, getting something through Congress, finally, that actually, you know, when you look at the guts of this bill, stopping human trafficking, right, pretty important issue, trumping maybe some of these other issues.
Well, I'm not so sure if many of these young women who have been trafficked have been raped, have been impregnated, for heaven's sake, why wouldn't funds help them to get an abortion?
Well, and this is the issue that Democrats raise, which is, look, the Hyde Amendment specifically refers to taxpayer funds.
Exactly.
This is a fee assessed to the bad guys, right? These aren't tax dollars. So once you start expanding the definition of the Hyde Amendment, we can start expanding it on and on and on and on.
That's a good point.
And that was their concern with it. It's not just simply it's about the Hyde Amendment. But the fact of the matter is, the one thing I will say about should they know, should they not have known, look, these are staffers. Their job is to read very technical information. I don't know how to read that because I don't do that for a living. But people who are staff members, it was a 48, 49-page bill. This wasn't thousands and thousands of pages. Should be going through it with a fine-tooth comb.
But if Amy Klobuchar's people did go through it with a fine-tooth comb and discover it.
And didn't say anything, I don't know.
All I'll say that I know is that she's been tasked on behalf of Democrats of finding the type of legislation that can move in a bipartisan fashion quickly through the Senate. And this has always been seen as an issue that could move. Whether they caught the abortion thing and that's the holdup now, look, that's separate to it. But back to the original point on Loretta Lynch, important to keep in mind, it's been about 131 days and counting. That is still second to Ed Meese, who was held up back in the Reagan administration for almost a year because they were investigating his finances. So it's a long time. And it's certainly long for an historic nominee, but it is not the longest, and Republicans like to remind Democrats about that.
But you have totally to wonder what... different kinds
Absolutely.
Of hold-up issues.
You have to wonder what's going through Eric Holder's head, too.
Right.
I mean, this guy said last year, I'm ready to retire. And
he also said, I'll stay
Indeed.
Until you've got a new person in place, and... Are Republicans happy to keep him in place?
And I think that's the irony of the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, people were going to support anyone that Obama nominated just because that person would not be named Eric Holder.
And he said this week, it's almost as if the Republicans have discovered a new fondness for me. Even his spokesman, I think, was tweeting on this week to reporters, like, he will stay as long as needed, which was a subtle way of saying to Republicans, your worst nightmare is still in office.
But
maybe you should speed it up.
Let me ask you, is talking about race here a fair issue? The Congressional Black Caucus raised it. John McCain said, absolutely not. What's your thinking?
I don't know. I guess where I come down to is this is as much about the frustration over immigration as it is about Loretta Lynch. I think regardless of who this person was, there would be a holdup because Republicans, as Ed pointed out, they don't have many Trump cards left to fight what they see as a president who keeps using executive orders to supersede them. And so whenever they get an opportunity to say to Democrats, okay, you can do what you want to do, but it will cost you this, they're going to use that opportunity.
I think that's true. And I think that, you know, reasonable people, again, on this issue will disagree as to whether there's a racial undertone or not. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to the issue of immigration, which, let's be honest, also has racial undertones. But in this case, it's about policy and it's about.
Yeah,
what
I mean, I don't think Republicans are doing. I guess I'll push back even harder. I do not think that Republicans are using race as an issue.
All right.
And it was Dick Durbin, the Democrat of Illinois, who said that Lynch is being asked to, quote, sit in the back of the bus.
Right.
Within hours, Senate Republicans pushed back and said, that's funny, because you're the guy who voted against Condoleezza Rice for Secretary of State right around the 40th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday mm-hmm. marches. So if you want to call yeah. A spade, we're more than happy to do that.
All right. Let's talk about the White House Secret Service, which seems to be having continuing problems.
Never a dull moment.
Never
with the Secret
a dull
Service
moment.
In the White House. The latest is that the new director, Joe Clancy, was testifying this week and was really grilled by Congress or by lawmakers for an incident in which two Secret Service members approached the White House in a car and hit a security barrier and may have been intoxicated. And he didn't find out about it until a good 5 days afterwards.
I don't get that.
And I don't think he gets it either.
I don't get that.
And he said that was unacceptable. And then he proceeded to say that it will take some time to earn trust with the Secret Service and to change the culture. And the lawmakers absolutely did not accept that as an explanation.
Well, you've got another element of loss of trust, which is that the video, surveillance video, has been wiped out, Amy.
Yeah, that they apparently rerun over the tapes every 3 days so that they're constantly erased, which nobody seemed to know that either. It seems like if you're the Secret Service, having video would be kind of an important part of your job.
Useful.
Right? Yeah. Now, maybe they archive it somewhere else before they erase it, but it doesn't sound like that may be the case either. I don't know.
It is one thing for the press to kind of stand back and say, oh, isn't this ridiculous? Isn't this funny? But for heaven's sake, the safety of the president of the United States is at stake with people jumping over fences, going through unlocked doors. What has happened to our Secret Service, and can Clancy reignite that feeling?
That's what he was. That was what he was supposed to do. And about 2 months in, he's not doing that well. In this case, the cover-up's worse than the crime, it seems. I mean, the fact that he revealed, and that lawmakers didn't know that this video thing is the norm. I have a feeling that will change very quickly. They don't ever make the argument, but I think we have to step back and realize now, this is an agency that's only got a few hundred guys who can do, and women, who can do the most sensitive work, which is protect a protectee. Ever since 2007, when you had to deploy dozens, if not hundreds, of agents onto a campaign trail, in addition to guarding a president, in addition to guarding former presidents, in addition to guarding any foreign leader that comes to the country, this is an agency that has been very much strained for the last 6 or 7 years under new, you know, post-9/11 realities. And they probably don't get enough rest. They certainly don't get enough training. There aren't enough of them. And it's a great example of what happens when a federal agency struggles in an environment where the budget is so constrained. Again, this is why Congress needs to pass a budget.
So does the president still have faith in Clancy?
We know he does so far. I mean, I think they've reiterated that this week. I'm just waiting for the memoirs one day to see if him or the First Lady finally admit, you know what, I was a little scared and upset about this. They won't say it now, but I have a feeling one day they might.
And meanwhile, we have some apparent cyanide being mailed into the White House.
It caught at a intercepting center where letters to the White House first come. Yes, and the envelope tested presumptively positive for cyanide.
Right, positive.
And it's undergoing other tests. The Secret Service made a point of saying that the person who opened up or noticed the envelope was not exposed, and there were no injuries. But it's freaky when something like this starts happening again.
And apparently, the sender, a man in Chicago with some mental health problems.
And a history of having made these types of threats before. I mean, that's usually the case in these male poisoning situations, that it's somebody who does this to a lot of people or tries to do it to a lot of different people. And the White House male security system, second to none, I think. And this is one part of the security element that actually has proven to work, because the mail all has to go to this separate offsite location, get reviewed by people, basically get frayed on the way in and tested and heated in the event that there is something. And, you know, this appears to be an isolated incident. The problem for the Secret Service is these things all seem to come in clumps.
Yeah.
There seem to be two or three problems, it goes away, and then more problems come up again.
Indeed.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. All right, Aaron Schock, surprise resignation. By the gentleman who created an office to replicate Downton Abbey, who apparently put in for 190,000 miles for reimbursement when his automobile had only 80,000 miles on it. So he has resigned. Rather abruptly, which means apparently that with his resignation, the Congress is not going to pursue any action. But we just learned that federal probers in Springfield, Illinois, are looking into that spending.
That's right. Well, remember, what you have is a sort of a pattern here. This is a young guy, he's 33 years old, I think the first congressman elected from the 1980s when he was elected in 2008. He liked a certain lifestyle, and he Instagrammed about it a lot. Oh, look, here I am in the Andes, you know, paragliding. Here I am in another beautiful locale. Here are my six-pack abs on the front of Men's Health. He liked being in the spotlight, and he apparently liked a certain lifestyle. There were a lot of private planes that he took. There were a lot of trips overseas that he did not bill properly. He did not tell the government where he was going. And so what you found was example after example, once people started digging into this, it wasn't just this car incident. It was a flight to a Bears game on a private plane that was charged. There were trips to New York. And so I think what you found was a guy who kind of got ahead of himself. Now, one reason you resign, you're right, Diane, you resign because then the ethics investigation goes away. But obviously, Fed's looking into how taxpayer dollars may be being spent and misspent.
He did apparently attempt to pay back.
He paid some things back. He paid back
the mileage.
He paid back some of the flights.
Right. Yeah. But here's the question. When, as you say, a young man, a young woman coming into Congress for the first time, what kinds of heads up do they get about what they can and cannot do or should and should not do?
Well, the American public will be...
They come to
Washington for new member orientation. Amy, you know this well. And they have days' worth of training sessions, and it includes a review of the ethics rules. Whether everyone shows up and listens is another thing. But they definitely provide them with the guidance. And the parties do a good job of reminding people. You have to be very careful. There are reams of campaign finance lawyers on both sides.
What about his colleagues? Did they not say something to him?
There's some belief, at least at the National Republican Congressional Committee, where he did a lot of work on fundraising, a lot of eye-rolling and some sort of annoyance at his extravagant demands that he get these private jets.
Eye-rolling? I mean, is that going to do it, Ed O'Keefe? I'm not sure. We're going to take a short break here. And don't forget, you can watch this hour of the Friday News Roundup. Go to drshow.org and click on Watch Live. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emma, email marketing for the modern brand, featuring email marketing software, automation tools to send personalized messages, and built-in analytics on desktop and mobile devices. Learn more at myemma.com. And from CFP, on behalf of Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to the highest standard in personal financial advice to help plan for major life events and reaching financial goals at letsmakeaplan.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu now says he supports a two-state solution. ISIS claims responsibility for a deadly museum attack in Tunisia. And Japan arrests a suspect in threats against the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. The Fed has signaled it may raise interest rates later this year. That language was really rather interesting from Janet Yellen.
Yeah, you know, I am not a Fed watcher, but I enjoy listening to people who watch the Fed. I guess they look at us the same way, people who watch politics and thinking, gosh, you guys are splitting the tiniest hairs.
Right.
You focus on the most obscure things. The word patient was removed. And what it suggested was the Fed is getting ready to make a rate hike probably this fall.
She did not say, I am not substituting the word
impatient.
Correct.
There we go. Sorry. So it's even more splitting of hairs than that. you know, look, going back to the point you made earlier about the economy getting better, this should be a good sign for all of us in this country that the Fed is feeling better, good enough to say this is going to be coming. We're feeling, you know, they did downgrade a bit the talk about more robust growth for the economy. Yes, there's always a concern about inflation, but not as much as they'd been worried about in the past. And so here's a chance for the Fed to weigh in as well as the markets to say, we think things are getting better. We expect, they didn't say we expect to make a change, but there are expectations that we'll see a rise in the rate there. And that also sets up for talk on the campaign trail about what this means for the economy.
But the question is when, and the markets responded to that ambiguity. I mean, Janet Yellen did not rule out the possibility of raising interest rates in June, which I think is what markets were originally expecting. But then because the Fed also said, we released some economic reports saying actually unemployment could come down significantly more without a risk to inflation, led people to wonder whether that interest rate would not be delayed quite much later in the year. And that was welcomed by investors who see joy in having a little longer reprieve. Stock markets went up. The dollar fell, although the dollar then recovered a little bit in subsequent
trading. People are saying that if indeed the Fed, or when the Fed does get around to raising interest rates, that the markets likely will not drop as sharply as they have in the past.
And probably because of this caution to some extent. Yeah, I think they're very, you know, they know that we're coming out of a downturn like no other.
You
bet. And there's real concern, again, because you look at the structural numbers and data underneath the top line unemployment rate, and they worry that it could be a real problem.
All right. I want to ask you all about something that usually does not come up on the Friday News Roundup, and that's sports. You have a young 24-year-old football player saying he's going to retire because he decided that the risks of playing football outweigh the benefits.
Fascinating story. His name is Chris Borland. He plays for the San Francisco 49ers. And as you said, 24 years old, was looking at a career where he could have made millions and millions of dollars because he's a very successful player. And he said he had a minor concussion and that minor concussion had raised questions for him as to how long he wanted to do this. And he essentially decided, based on the science and a lot of attention that's been going to this issue, that he didn't want to risk the issue of long-term brain injury and that it was more important to him to have an additional 15, 20 years of life at the end of his life than to have a lot of money now in his career.
So how do you think the NFL could be affected by this?
Well, I think more than anything, it feeds the concerns of parents who hear from their young son, I want to play football, and they go, well, gosh, if a 24-year-old linebacker who just passed up a four-year, $2.9 million contract says he doesn't want to do this, why should I let my son play Pop Warner? And it's been one of the biggest concerns for the NFL in recent years, that the whole culture of football and of doing it as a young child and graduating up through the ranks and maybe becoming a pro is really at risk. But I saw an interview with this guy, Chris Borland, yesterday, and he made it pretty clear. You know, I've spent this past season really thinking about this. I talked to neurosurgeons. I talked to colleagues. I talked to my agent. And since he made the announcement, he said, I have heard overwhelmingly from former players who said, you know what, you're doing the right thing. Kudos to you for having the courage to walk away and not thinking that a $2.9 million contract is the be-all, end-all of your life.
And those former players who have suffered concussions themselves have multi-million dollar suits against the NFL.
Well, and multi-million dollar medical bills that aren't necessarily getting paid. The one issue, though, is the fact that The NFL still remains incredibly popular, as does college football. This has not decreased America's interest in the sport. And I think that's where the disconnect is, because I think you're going to have now sort of a haves and have-nots in terms of who's playing football and who's not playing football. Nobody's saying, you know what? At least I have not heard. Let's all turn off NFL football. That'll teach them.
Until
they fix this, we're not going to watch NFL. They make billions of dollars. The Super Bowl is still the most talked about sporting event.
But I would not be surprised because of exactly what you said. For it to take a while, come up through the ranks, if I had a young son that age, you can bet I would have something.
And the inverse is true, too. If you look back at the late 80s and the 90s is when soccer took off as a popular sport.
Sure.
20 years later, now that all those kids are adults, look at the fact that soccer TV ratings are now higher than they've ever been. And they say it's because kids started playing it at a young age and interest grew.
Right.
So conceivably, if participation drops now, in 20, 30 years, perhaps ratings will fall.
And it has gotten so much attention. I mean, even President Obama was asked to weigh in if he had a son, if he would let his son play football. And he said, he'd have to think about that.
Yeah.
So a lot of parents are making those decisions. And I think you're right, Diane, that that's where it'll have a longer term effect.
Absolutely.
But it's starting now.
All right. Let's open the phones to James in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
One, Diane, love your show. And real quick, for what you just spoke on, you actually had a very informative show on that late last year, I believe, or mid last year.
Yes, we did.
But I wanted the panel to assess the economy the last 5 years. And where I'm going is usually when something happens revolving around Washington and it's bad, the president gets blamed for it. And usually when something good happens, the president gets kudos for it. Now, you all did mention the Fed a little while ago, and there's still the Congress and Wall Street. So if I could get the three panelists' assessment of the last 5 years and why the president should or shouldn't get credit for the economy.
Yeah.
All right.
Go ahead.
Well, so there are a lot of factors that go into an economic downturn and an economic upturn, for sure. The president has said many times that when he came into office, he was surprised at how bad it was, and that's one reason that he chose to focus as much time on the economy as he did instead of some of the other policy areas that he'd made promises about in his campaign. So the administration took a lot of steps. Some of them were very controversial.
But you gotta say, he also took a lot of heat for those.
For sure. And I was just going to say, one of those was the stimulus that they introduced at the very beginning of his term. Many within his administration would have liked that stimulus to have been significantly bigger.
Right.
Many Republicans thought it was a mistake entirely. And I think most economists now would agree that that stimulus absolutely helped boost the economy. So to the caller's question, yes. I mean, some of what he did for sure helped the economy. Obviously, what the Fed did with quantitative easing and its other monetary policy tools also has helped the economy, and that continues to be debated now.
All right, Amy.
You know, this is something we've seen sort of throughout the course of modern times, and by modern meaning since the 80s, which is when the economy improves, who gets credit and who gives credit. And, you know, what we've seen eroding over time, really since the days of Ronald Reagan, is that the other party willing to give the president, if he's not of your party, credit for an improving economy. You know, more Democrats gave Ronald Reagan credit than Republicans gave Clinton, and now that Republicans give Obama. That said, it's never been a big margin, right? If you are the opposite party, no matter how great things are going, you think the person in the White House is doing a terrible job. We've just become even more, I think, emboldened in that perception over the last 10 or 15 years.
In Obama's case, do not forget, it was from day one. We want to see this president fail.
Right, the stimulus got, what, three Republicans?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Ed, you're up, but very briefly.
I mean, look,
please.
The unemployment rate is down, but I look at the labor participation rate, James, and you see that so many more people aren't working or aren't seeking work for some reason. I don't know what the answer is. Anecdotally, traveling the country, talking even to relatives and friends, they're better employed than they were, and many of them lost jobs. You go to some states in this country, if you were there 8 years ago following the campaign, things look pretty bad. They're starting to come back. Storefronts are filled. There's new restaurants and businesses opening up. People do seem happier. So I look at it more anecdotally, and yes, the economy's doing better.
All right.
That's probably partly, as Jeff said, because the stimulus was there to save us from the precipice.
All right, let's go to Tom in Durham, New Hampshire. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Well, I think one of the big problems in economic confidence and just confidence in the country as a whole stems from the fact that we keep electing people that can't work together and get anything done. The only civil discourse that I know of in Washington is your show. Speaking
you
as a man,
see us backstage.
speaking as a man who's 55 years old, I have retirement in the not so distant future. I have a 15-year-old and 11-year-old who want to go to university. I have a sister who's 19 years younger than me who has $150,000 worth of debt from law school.
Whoa!
And we're talking about we talk about things in wonks and widgets.
Yeah.
We're people, man. We're the middle class, and all we hear is things pulled out from underneath us.
And it seems to me that that impassioned statement is representative of a great many.
And there are, there is economic data to show that. I mean, when over the past several years that the president has been in office, there have been the fiscal cliff, the budget deficit, the debt ceiling debates, all of those things that brought the economy up to the precipice have had an effect on growth, and that all comes down to the two parties not being able to agree.
All right. Ed O'Keefe, I want to ask you about the arrest of a young black University of Virginia student. The governor of Virginia has ordered state police to investigate that arrest. Tell us what happened.
Well, what's most interesting about this was involving a 20-year-old named Martise Johnson, who's a student at UVA, University of Virginia in Charlottesville, tried to get into an Irish pub late St. Patrick's Day into the next day, was refused entry because he's only 20, and then essentially gets arrested and thrown to the ground by law enforcement officials who are not Charlottesville police, who are not Virginia State Police, but who work for the Virginia Alcohol and Beverage Control, the ABC. If you drive through Virginia, they're everywhere. They're the only ones that can sell liquor. Turns out, I didn't realize this, there are hundreds of ABC agents who are across the state who are primarily tasked with curbing underage drinking and other behaviors that come with drinking a lot of alcohol or beer. And they took this guy down, and students captured video of it. It has become a very big concern there in Charlottesville and for the state. They're investigating it, and it raises a lot of questions about the legal parameters of this board.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now, we know his face was bloodied.
Yes.
We don't know whether it happened when he fell, when they pushed him down, or whether he was actually beaten.
Well, I think what we don't know is what happened before he went on the ground, right? Which is what you see in the video and in the pictures is a guy on the ground, face bleeding, with officers sitting on top of him. I think there are three officers. What you don't know is what was the interaction between those officers and the student before that. But the bottom line is, again, these are ABC officers who are questioning a kid who tried to get into a bar. There's no reason that any 20-year-old kid should be thrown to the ground with three grown men on top of him for whatever was said, right, before this incident. And that is, I think, what you're getting at, really, to the heart of this question, is it's not just the ABC, but again, it's questions about were they picking on this kid in particular because this bar had a history of singling out African Americans. Did the ABC have a habit of singling out African Americans?
And this group has a history. This law enforcement agency. We discovered at the Post that in April 2013, some plainclothes officers had confronted a student in Charlottesville, and pulled a gun on her, because they suspect that she was carrying a six-pack of beer when all it was a six-pack of flavored sparkling water. And she, you know, basically ended up with a $200,000 settlement in her favor over this because they said, you're approaching me in a supermarket parking lot with a gun because you think I'm carrying a six-pack? And this was a woman, and this, I believe she was white.
Yeah.
So, again, it's not just necessarily a racial thing. This could be a broader concern about this very specific agency and what it's tasked with doing.
And, of course, you've got social media involved again.
For sure. And again, I mean, that picture went viral, and with good reason. It was a very damaging picture and very, very hard to see what had happened to him. And I think it's also interesting that Johnson, with all these protests, has also said he believes in peaceful protest, and he's not looking for big riots to happen there as they've happened in other places that we know.
But Governor McAuliffe has asked the state police in Virginia to investigate what happened here. I hope we all find out what happens afterwards. Thank you all so much for being here on this snowy Washington day. First day of spring. You're in a pink jacket. He's got on a pink tie. Where's your pink?
This is my Friday casual.
I'm in purple.
I didn't get the memo.
Ed O'Keefe of the Washington Post, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, Jeff Mason of Reuters, thanks again. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.